So we're going to go back to that passage in Psalm 39. If you haven't ever heard the words, "Your call is important to us, you will do before too long," everybody must hear those words sooner or later. And we all know what that means when we hear that. Pretty much the exact opposite of "your call is important to us." More like, "We're far too busy to speak to you right now, but if you can summon up an extraordinary level of patience and hang on, one of our hard-pressed operatives who's really busy right now answering a million other phone calls like yours, most of them probably far more important than yours, will eventually get round to you, so please do hang on. And by the way, your call is important to us," and so on and so on. You see, sometimes we're brought to see just how insignificant and small and transient and of little consequence we are. The problem this psalm is complaining about, or where it starts, is something that we all experience to some degree, and we see it in verses 4 to 6. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at that complaint, and then we're going to look at what's the underlying cause of that complaint. What is it that caused the psalmist to be in this situation, to feel the way that he does? Where has this problem come from? Why is he experiencing this problem? And then thirdly, we'll see, having understood how this situation came about, we'll ask with him, is there any hope for him? Is there any way he can get back to where he knows he should be? So that'll be the problem, the cause of the problem, or the problem under the problem, if you like, and the solution. But before we even get to the problem, we're going to dive straight into the psalm by starting exactly where the writer himself starts and asking the question, when you've got some problem or difficulty, you will inevitably experience some negative emotions. Could be sadness or fear or anxiety or anger, perhaps. And this is inevitable in human life. Difficulties and problems can provide an opportunity for us to grow in character and depth and resilience and so on, but also they can get us stuck and they can overcome us. And so when these negative emotions come, how can we avoid being overcome by them, being swamped by them? Well, we're getting our first lesson here before we even get to the first point, because the first line of the psalm goes straight to that issue. How do you deal with these negative emotions? Now, when we think about that, there are two problems to avoid when it comes to feeling these difficult emotions. One mistake we can make is to think of emotions as a bad thing, something to be avoided or repressed or denied. And perhaps this goes back to the days when, you know, emotions used to be pitted against reason and thinking and intellect. They were thought of as a bad thing. And that's the sort of, in times gone by, that was a religious way perhaps of thinking about emotions, something that we would suppress or avoid or cover up or just try to put to one side. Perhaps in days gone by, that was a way that people dealt with emotions. Our age certainly doesn't deal with emotions that way, and in fact tends to make the opposite mistake. We live in a time when emotions are actually privileged, and we talk about owning and expressing and making your feelings work for you, being true to your feelings and so on. We talk about that's the way to be a well-integrated human. But the Bible doesn't recommend either of those ways of dealing with emotions. The Psalms are full of examples of people pouring out their doubt and their grief and their guilt and their anger. Where? In front of God. David does it. Job did it. And they both model what we should do when we have a problem like this, a case against God, if you like. We bring it to him. We don't resolve a problem with God anywhere but with God himself. So let's avoid the so-called religious way of denying our emotions, and let's avoid the secular way of seeing emotions as an end in themselves. But let's process our emotions before God. Let's pray them, bring them before God and process them. That's exactly what the psalmist does here. So we'll go now straight to the problem that he has. The word which describes his problem comes three times in the psalm. You see it in verse 5, where it's translated vapor, and in verse 6, it's translated shadow, and it comes again in verse 11, where it's translated vapor again. And it's a word that means things are pointless or empty. Perhaps meaningless could be another translation. A deep sense of going nowhere. Life is not adding up to anything. It's not going anywhere. And even if I do something, no one's going to remember it. Everything you do is going to come to nothing. That is really where his problem starts. Now, we all experience this to some degree, but it is perfectly possible with a combination of busyness and having things to do and just not thinking too hard to get on with life perfectly well, so that you just carry on and you don't face up to this meaninglessness. And we see that actually in verse 6 in the psalm, where there is a lot of activity. They busy themselves. He heaps up riches. There's bustling about. There's specifically the getting together of wealth and riches. And that is very effective, or can be very effective, at taking the mind away from the pointlessness of it all. Now, the world we live in is very similar to the world the psalmist lived in. And if anything, we've actually got more in the way of distractions and diversions than they would have had, because we've got a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week world. We've got gadgets and screens and all sorts of things that can keep us busy. And there are, even in our culture, things at work that will undermine our sense of personal significance all the time. We're surrounded by technology, but it's always wanting to reduce everything to ones and noughts. You're just a number on the line, or a statistic, or a commodity to be counted. And that can rob us of personal significance. Walk into one of those sort of modern glass and chrome buildings you get in any city centre. You see lots of sleek curves and edges. You'll see a big reception. There'll inevitably be a big screen somewhere there. And on that, there'll be figures that tell you how much energy has been saved in the last week, or by switching off lights or computers or whatever, or how much less carbon dioxide they've put out into the atmosphere compared to last year. But you don't see anything about the human resources of the organisation. You don't see anything about how happy the workers are, how fulfilled they are, how effective they are doing their job, and so on. And that is another trend that tends to erode our sense of personal significance. Another thing we have to face up to is our world is always engaged in reducing everything to its bare minimum. We're always trying to cut everything down to, you know, physics and chemistry, mass and energy and gravity. And some people try to tell us that's really all that human beings are. We're just a collection of genes and molecules and atoms bouncing together, having come together from random, and that's really all that we add up to. That's a very common view you see in the world today. And all of that adds up to a sense of insignificance and not really meaning anything. So we can be busy and distracted, and we can be not thinking about what it all means. And then what happens to the psalmist? Something happens to him that causes him to consider, what is the point of this? What am I doing here? Something happens that pulls him or us up short. It might be something unexpected, and it forces us to look at how we're living and to ask some of those deeper questions. In the psalm, it looks like it's some sort of health concern, because if you read verse 4, he's talking about the end of his life. When is it going to be? And he specifically talks about understanding that he's frail. So perhaps he's facing some illness, or he's perhaps even threatened with the end of his life. And that has forced him to ask some questions about what he's doing. And specifically that question might be, why? Why are you doing what you're doing? What is the point of it? Now, the Bible has dramatic examples of other people facing up to that question. Perhaps a very memorable one would be Saul of Tarsus. He was held up in a very dramatic fashion on the road to Damascus with that very question, why? If you read Hello magazine, the TV presenter Nick Knowles is on last week's, and he's being interviewed about an episode recently in his life. And he, in his interview, he says, it was then, he's talking about a recent health scare, it was then I realised I needed to reevaluate my way of life. I'd let my fitness slip. When you're on the road as much as I am, sometimes clocking up thousands of miles a week, you grab what food you can, and it's not easy to find the time to exercise. That, on top of the frenetic pace I was working at, had taken its toll. I was burnt out, and I owed it to the people I love to sort it out. So he has a health scare, and it brings him to realise that all those things he'd been working on and busy with, didn't mean as much as he thought they did after all. He comes to see his own mortality, and that causes him to reevaluate and to think again. And that's, I think, what happens to David here. He realizes he's mortal, he's possibly facing the end of his life, and it causes him to stop and to think. So how do we deal with this? We see our position in the world. We get a view of our insignificance and of how short our life can be. What do we do? Well, we do exactly what Nick Knowles did. We look at ourselves and we think about how we're living, and what our priorities are, and we reevaluate things. Life is more than just activity and earning and working and doing stuff. But if you look at verse 6, it reads, "Surely they busy themselves in vain. He heaps up riches and does not know who will gather them." That activity, is that rational activity? He heaps up riches, he does not know who'll gather them. That is not rational, that is compulsion. That person is being driven to do what he's doing. And that takes us to our second point. Because in that verse, you see a lot of activity. I mean, you can see the verbs. He's busy, he heaps up riches, he's bustling about. Yes, this is busyness. Yes, this is doing stuff. But this is not just going round and round in circles. This is not just activity that you could decide to stop it just if you wanted to. This is something more than that. This is being driven by something. This is what the Bible calls elsewhere worship. You might not think of it as worship when you read that, but that's exactly what it is. And we are actually built to worship. We have to worship. We can't just get up and live lives without a purpose. We have to do it for something. As Bob Dylan said, everybody's serving something. Something is our ultimate concern. We have to rely on something. And whatever those things are, those things we are given to. We worship him. And the book of Ecclesiastes, which is in a way the sort of Old Testament book that this psalm is looking back to, this book, the book of Ecclesiastes, goes through a long list of all the possible things there are in life that you can worship, from wisdom and understanding to expertise and scholarship. There's pleasure and comfort, fun, laughter, aesthetics, sex, arts, power, popularity, acclaim. Some of those things were driving Nick Knowles, as it turns out, before he had his rethink. And what's the result? It's always the same. You end up thinking, what have I accomplished? Where has this got me? In this particular case, in the psalm, it looks like it's something to do with wealth and riches. We see that in verse 6 and also in verse 11. And before you know it, whatever that thing is, in this case, it's money or wealth that has become the thing that the psalmist is driven by. And before you know it, you're worshipping it, you're given to it, it has control over you. That's now what rules your life. So yes, we have to have something to live for. Yes, we must have something we're given to. But in this case, it seems to be that it's wealth and riches that he's given to. Now, whatever it is, doesn't have to be something that's necessarily bad, because it's possible at this point to make another mistake. If you think back to Ecclesiastes and that list of things that we might give ourselves to worship, it's possible to look at that list and say, okay, let's categorize those things in terms of things that are more or less worthy. And I can transfer my allegiance to something that's less worthy to something that's more worthy. And that's really the mistake that Nick Knowles made, because he realizes, yes, all those things he's been driven by are ultimately not taking him anywhere. And then he comes to see that his own family is the most important thing, and that's what he's going to look after from now on. So he's transferred his allegiance from his work and his career and his earning to looking after his immediate family. Now, at one level, that's a good thing to do, but we've got to realise that there's a potential mistake in there. Yes, we all acknowledge that there's definitely meaning in human relationships that must surpass anything in the material realm, anything to do with money or working and so on. But the problem with human relationships is they are subject to exactly the problem that we started out with. They're human, and therefore they're short-lived. Even the best human relationship, the best marriage, the best friendship, the best family, that all will come to an end. You see, death will end everything, and whether life is shorter or longer, all of those relationships, if they're the only source of meaning to us, they'll end as well. So where does that leave us? Well, it could leave us just cycling from one thing to another at different stages of life, but always given over to something. Maybe at one time of life it's your career, maybe at another time of life it's some relationship, then it's your kids, then it's your career again, repeatedly finding each thing unfulfilling and unsatisfying. Ultimately, while we hurry towards the end of life, is there something that's big enough to give meaning? Is there something which to worship or whom to worship could fill us and make us whole rather than consuming and driving us and leaving us ultimately empty? Well, of course, the psalmist's answer is there is. There is a relationship that can outlast death. There is a relationship that death won't end. Go back to verse 4 and see who it is that the psalmist makes his appeal to. That person is the Lord. It's God, the creator of the universe. And right at the beginning of his complaint, he actually acknowledges by using that title, Lord, L-O-R-D, in capitals, that yes, the human soul is made to be filled with something. Yes, it's empty without a purpose. It needs to have something to live for, something to worship. But that can't be just anything. The human soul is so big that there's only that one thing can fill it, a relationship with God himself, the Lord. You see, having realized that the whole universe ultimately comes down to this meaninglessness, he does the only thing you can really do. He calls out to the one who made the whole universe in the first place. The only thing in the universe that's not created, the only thing that's ultimately real and has meaning. And he addresses his complaint to the Lord, verse 4. But even to use that title, Lord, L-O-R-D, in capitals, brings to mind something very, very important. You see, this world that we live in, all the things that we enjoy and do and talk about, that does not belong to us in the first place. We don't own it. We don't deserve it. It's not really ours, even our very souls. And you see, this address to the Lord tells us that when you deal with this God, the God who made the universe, there are terms, there are conditions. Call out to this God by all means, but this is the real God, the God who made the universe. And when you approach him, there's protocol. There are things to do. This is the God who made the universe, not a God of your own imagination, not a God of your own making, not some genie in a bottle, but the God who made the universe. You can only worship one thing at a time. Worship of that one thing precludes worship of everything else. And when God gave his people that title, Lord, in verse 4, he set out those terms and conditions, and they are known in the Bible as the covenant. You see, he's not one thing to be worshipped among many. He made the world and he made you, and you belong completely to him. And the only reason you can take your next breath is because this God has decided not yet to call time on his covenant. You see, the terms are, I'll let you live on my earth as my creature, but I demand your whole worship, 100%. I must be the most important thing. I must be the center of everything. Every decision must be made in reference to me. We are to love this God, to use some words from elsewhere in the Bible, with all of our heart, soul, strength, and mind. Those are the terms of the covenant. And anything short of that isn't just failure to worship, it's actually outright rebellion. This is to phone, to go back to the your call is important to us thing, this is to phone the utility company or the electricity company or whatever, and rather than hearing your call is important to us, which we dread, rather it's, we know you, you owe us, you're not in good standing with us, you're in debt to us, You can't pay your debt, and from now on, you're cut off from us forever. You will never again receive water or electricity or whatever it is. Those are the terms of the covenant. You are in violation of it, and we'll have to endure the consequences of that. So where does that leave us? There's this meaninglessness in the universe and in our lives. We're brought to realise that we've been dealing with this by compulsive service. In this case, wealth. And the writer goes to the only source of meaning and significance there is. He calls out to the only source of meaning in the universe, the creator of it all, only to find that his position in front of that God is a violator of his covenant. He's the only source of meaning in the universe. A relationship with him is the only thing in life that can fill us and satisfy us, only to find that we're excluded from that relationship as breakers of his covenant, and therefore doomed to a short, meaningless existence on earth and an eternity outside the only source of satisfaction there is. Only perfect obedience to the terms of that covenant could admit us into that ultimate relationship. Anything short of that 100% total perfect obedience is really worshipping something else. That's what the Bible refers to as, verse 8, transgressions, or verse 8, transgressions. And it's at this point that the writer cries out, verse 8, save me or deliver me. Because this is indeed a bleak situation. And that takes us to our third point. Is there anywhere he can go from here? Is there any solution to this problem? There's a sense that everything's worthless and comes to nothing. There's a realization that he's been worshipping something that's inadequate, that just can't fill the human soul. The cause of the problem is to see that there's something, or rather someone, whom to worship can really fill us and satisfy us. But we find that while we've been worshipping other things, we have fallen foul of the terms of his covenant. And so we get the language of verses 10 and 11. The plague, the blow, the rebuke, the correction. Those are the covenant terms. Those are what happens to those who forfeited the covenant by their worshipping elsewhere. So he cries out, deliver me. And he realises, verse 7, that if there's a way out of this problem, it must be God's way out. My hope is in you. And his prayer to be saved from this comes in the final two verses, and it's an impassioned plea for sure. Now, it starts in the right place, verse 12, by realizing that there's nothing I can do to get out of this situation. If something is to be done, then God himself has to do it, because that's where all the interaction with the God of this universe must begin, by realizing that we have no claim on him, no grounds for approaching him, nothing at all we can offer that could bridge the gap between me and him. If there are any grounds at all to which he can appeal, we see that halfway down verse 12, because he says, for I am a stranger with you, and that for could be because. So if there are any grounds for his prayer, it's in those words following that for or because. And those grounds are what? He describes himself as an alien and a stranger. And we know from elsewhere in the Bible that God has always been known for being kind and well disposed towards aliens and strangers. So what he's saying is, if I consider myself among the aliens and the strangers, then maybe God will take pity on me. If I renounce all the advantages I have in my morality, my pedigree, my intelligence, my birthright, family, connections, accomplishments, whatever it is, if I count myself among the aliens and strangers, then maybe God will take pity on me. But he doesn't seem to have much confidence that this will work, because the last verse is pretty bleak. He writes, remove your gaze from me that I may regain strength before I go away and am no more. Just take away this gnawing emptiness, this sense of inadequacy for one last time so that I might enjoy my life briefly before it's all over. Not much hope or confidence that God can do something. But remember, This is the God who made the universe and who made us. If there's anything that can be done about this, it must be him. Our hope must be in him, verse 7. And yes, the prayer doesn't contain much confidence of being answered. In our language, we would say it doesn't contain much faith. But it's not the amount of faith that matters. It's what the faith grabs onto. Because the weakest faith can grab hold of this God, and then amazing things can happen. Now, this particular psalm doesn't resolve that issue for us. Really, it ends there with him crying out for God to be rescued. Not at all sure that there's a way out. Only sure that if there is a way out, it must be God's way out. If there's any hope, verse 7 again, it must be in God. But I believe there is hope in this prayer. And I want us to finish by looking at those words again in verse 13. Remove your gaze, or as the NIV has it, look away. Why does he talk like that? Why does he ask God to look away? What's this issue with God looking at us? Well, I think it's to do with the fact that in order to have a relationship with this God, in order to be in a relationship with him, just as on the human level, there's got to be an eye-to-eye contact. There's got to be heart-to-heart or soul-to-soul, if you like. When he looks at us and he sees us, that means more than just he sees us as I see you right now. He sees inside us. His gaze is able to see all the elements of our rebellion, all of our false worship, all the things that we've done that have violated the terms of his covenant. That's what it means to come before the gaze of this God. And that leaves us stuck in an impossible place, because if we come before his gaze, then he's going to see everything about us. His gaze is going to perceive our rebellion and our selfishness and all that we've done and all that we are that's offensive to him. But if he looks away, then there's no relationship and we're out in the cold and we're on our own. Is there any other way? Is there any way other than him looking at you and burning you up with the fiery purity of his gaze? As the prophet complained to God, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. You see, we can't bear this God to look at us, and yet we can't have a relationship with him unless he looks at us. Where can we go from here? Is this really hopeless? Could there be some way of deflecting the gaze of God's eye? Could there be something or someone we could hide behind so that we could stay in the presence of God without being burned up? Verse 7 talks about my hope is in you. What could his hope be? David, the writer of the psalm, many years after, had a descendant. That person did and said amazing things. He made astounding claims about himself. He was a human descendant of David. But elsewhere in the Psalms, David actually calls that same person, who's his great, 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 however many greats, grandson. David also calls him the Lord. There's something very special about him. His life is recorded in detail for us in the Bible. And the thing that's really remarkable about his life is that the terms of that covenant, remember we called that love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength and mind, those terms he kept completely, totally, 100%, every last detail, nothing wrong at all. Now, how do we know this? Well, his enemies, who were actually experts in the small print of that covenant, they were constantly on the lookout to find some aspect of that agreement that he had broken. They're watching him the whole time, and even they couldn't find anything that he did wrong. So he kept the terms of that covenant 100%. He alone is qualified to have that relationship with God on the basis of that covenant. Nothing at all wrong. The only one who was ever actually qualified to look at God face to face. One day, that person called out to God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why do you look away from me? Why do you remove your gaze from me? You see, these two, the Father and the Son, have enjoyed each other's gaze for the whole of eternity. And now the Father, who is God, looks away from the Son, who is Jesus Christ. That's who we're talking about. And the Son asks the Father, why have you done this? And the answer is, he did it so that David, his human ancestor, and all of you and me and anyone who's willing to hide in him or to put their trust in him, as the Bible has it, can now endure the gaze of God's eye, can now look at God and have God look at them in the loving intimacy of that covenant, despite the fact that we've broken all its terms. You see, that relationship, that intimacy is now possible because of what happened that day on the cross. The Father looked away from the Son, which means that you and I can now be looked at by God. He was treated as an alien and a stranger so that you and I can be known and loved if we trust in him. And I want to finish just by being a bit more practical at the end, because I believe in this teaching there is both something here for us to avoid, a warning, and there is something here for us to do in response. So first of all, the warning. If you go back to the inscription at the very, very beginning, you see that the writer here, and we've mentioned his name several times, is David. Now, he is someone that we would think of as being fairly high up in Christian life, if you like, somebody whose relationship with God would be strong, someone that we would look up to in the Christian life, someone who's, as the Bible has it elsewhere, is mature in his Christian life. He's reached a high level of maturity. I mean, he's written the Psalms. Now, when he writes about, in verse 6, about the accumulation of wealth and riches, or rather the devotion to or the service of wealth and riches, there's more than one way he could be writing about that. He could be writing about it from a sort of high moral standpoint, as if to say, being given over to the service of wealth and riches in this way, that's something that happens to other people. But I think here, the reason he writes like this is because he himself suffered with this problem, at least at one stage in his life. He's writing this in a way to warn us, because if it can happen to him, then of course it can happen to us as well. So it's a call for us to watch out for those things to which we can be given over, those things that are always competing with God for our worship and service. So I believe that here, that this at one time was a problem for him, and that means it can also be a problem for us. So the warning is to watch out for those things that are always calling for our worship and our service, and be aware that they're out there and that they're always clamouring for our attention. That's the warning in the psalm, I think. And secondly, there's something that we can do in response here. You see, it appears as a crisis in David's life, as we read about it here. But it's something that's bubbling under the surface for all of us, I think, all of the time, because we're always being enticed by the promises of these other things. And we've said already, we've made a sort of a list of things it might be. We've talked about the fact that it could be money, but maybe it's other things, family or career or some relationship or some hobby, whatever it is. These things are all around us, and maybe they're not necessarily bad things, maybe they're good things, but they are competing with the God of the universe to be ultimate things in our lives. And that's a battle we need to fight constantly. And if you look at verse 3, there was a period of emotional turmoil in his life when he's really wrestling with this problem. And then in verse 3, he says, "While I was musing," or meditating as the NIV has it, there was a sort of period of clarity emerged, and he was able to write down all the things that we've just been thinking about, what he'd been experiencing in his spiritual life. And I think what we're being told here is that we have the opportunity to engage in this musing or meditation as a daily discipline, because this issue that was a crisis for him is really facing us all the time. Perhaps not at that same crisis level, but it's always there underneath the surface. Those things are always competing for our attention, always trying to drag our worship away from God and onto other things. And so I think the lesson for us is, make it a daily discipline to engage in that musing or meditation. What does that mean? Well, it just means the disciplines we engage in typically as Christians anyway, studying our Bibles, praying together, being accountable to one another, meeting together like this, all of those things. But we've got to acknowledge that this problem is there under the surface for all of us, and we've always got to be battling against it. And I think he's giving us the opportunity here to engage in that daily discipline of meditation so that you're always aware of that problem, and maybe you can avoid it becoming the crisis that it did for him. Now, sure, that crisis will come along from time to time, but I think the lesson here for us is to consider every day what are the other things that are trying to drag our worship away from God. So to summarise, yes, your life in terms of human years may be short or long, but don't try to find meaning in things or stuff or money or career. Don't even look to relationships, good though they might be, for ultimate meaning. Look instead to him. And now, because of Jesus on the cross, you don't need to be afraid of his gaze because of what Jesus did on the cross. Let that relationship be your ultimate meaning, that relationship which goes on forever, that is not ended by death. In fact, your death can only bring you closer to him. This is instead to ring the utility company or the electricity company to hear, "Ah, Mr. Smith, we've been trying to contact you. We've been looking for you. You're our 1 millionth customer. You're a highly valued customer. You've won a holiday or whatever it is. We have a check here with your name on it. You'll never pay for electricity again." That's a sort of dim picture of what's on offer in the gospel. A meaningless existence versus an eternal life filled with meaning inside a never-ending, eternally joyful relationship with the only one who can satisfy. We're going to finish by singing.